University of California Television presents this podcast of Into the Light of Day, Torture, Human Rights, and Bush's State of Exception, featuring journalist and UC Berkeley professor Mark Danner. This talk was recorded on the UC San Diego campus in February 2006. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
My name is Steve Adler. I'm the provost of Earl Warren College, a professor in the Department of Theater and Dance, and director of the Law and Society program here at UCSD. I would like to welcome you all on behalf of Chancellor Marianne Fox, Dean of Arts and Humanities Michael Bernstein, Dean of Social Sciences Paul Drake, and the Dean of California Western School of Law Stephen Smith, to the DeWitt Higgs Memorial Lecture, sponsored by Earl Warren College, UCSD's Law and Society program, and Cal Western School of Law. The Higgs Lecture is designed to present the UCSD and the San Diego communities with an evening of stimulating discourse on a legal topic of contemporary import. We believe that tonight's lecture by Professor Mark Danner of UC Berkeley and Bard College in New York, entitled Into the Light of Day, Torture, Human Rights, and Bush's State of Exception, will more than amply accomplish the goals of the Higgs Lecture, especially given recent events that have been circulating in the newspapers and on the web just today relative to Abu Ghraib. It's now my great pleasure to introduce you to a distinguished scholar and a nationally recognized leader in higher education, our chancellor here at UCSD, Dr. Marianne Fox.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome you this evening to the University of California at San Diego, and in particular to the DeWitt Higgs Memorial Lecture. I think this is very representative of what the private sector can do by contributing significantly to an endowed lecture, and to be able at the same time to pay tribute to DeWitt Higgs, who served for 16 years as the University of California regent, I think affirms the interactions that we've had have been so fruitful with the Higgs family. The lecture tonight really demonstrates UCSD's public service commitment. It allows us to expose the campus and the general public to current events and to controversies in the context of learning about the issues from the experts. This highlights UCSD as a campus because we engage the community in a discussion that I think will bring these really cutting-edge issues to the fore and allow us to explore them in the way that a scholarly investigator would do so. The topic is particularly relevant because of the circumstances that have recently been exposed at Abu Ghraib, in Afghanistan, and at Guantanamo Bay. It's clear that we as a nation must deal with these ideas. We must deal with the ramifications of what's gone on. And I think as a person and as a scholar, each of us must formulate a response. That's why our panel discussion and the lecture will be so stimulating tonight. Thank you very much for coming, and please enjoy the lecture.
Let me also welcome you all here tonight for the DeWitt Higgs Memorial Lecture, co-sponsored by a multitude of entities, including Social Sciences, Warren College, Cal Western School of Law, and the Law and Society program. We're very pleased tonight to have Professor Mark Danner from our sister institution up north. As you probably know, he's a professor of journalism at UC Berkeley. He went there after graduating from Harvard University. He's also a professor in the human rights program at Bard College. I first encountered him on the written pages of The New Yorker. I study Latin American politics myself and remember reading his scintillating and revealing pieces on Haiti and El Salvador, the latter of which was turned into a book. He has received many awards for his investigative journalism, 3 Overseas Press Awards, an Emmy, a National Magazine Award, and probably what's dearest to the heart of an academic, became a MacArthur Fellow, also known as a Genius Award. We're very pleased to have him here tonight. He'll be available afterwards, I gather, to sign his latest book, Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. We invited Vice President Dick Cheney to give a rebuttal to this talk tonight, but he was tied up with other things. Despite his absence, we're very pleased to have Professor Danner to talk to us about a very serious issue confronting the United States and indeed the world. He will talk tonight about Into the Light of Day, Torture, Human Rights, and Bush's State of Exception. Please welcome Mark Danner.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's good to be here.
Hello. Thank you very much, Dean Drake. Dick Cheney offering a rebuttal. The kind of rebuttals he's been offering lately, I think I'm very happy to be here by myself, at least for the time being. I actually, as many of you may know, the subject of torture has attained yet another flicker of prominence today with the release of more photographs from Abu Ghraib, including some video, which has had a very strong effect in parts of the Middle East. I have been traveling most of the day, but stopped in the hotel quickly and looked at CNN to see what the effect was on the American press, and all I saw was all Dick Cheney is shooter all the time. This was the entire story on CNN. I don't know. Well, I had the impression watching the coverage of this story that the press has a tendency, and I count myself as a proud member of the press, to strain after ridiculousness. And I'm afraid this story has reached that point. First of all, let me thank you very much for inviting me here tonight. It's a great honor to give this lecture named for DeWitt Higgs. I'm grateful to Chancellor Fox, to Provost Adler, Dean Drake, and all the kind words you've said about me. I was reading on the way down the biography of DeWitt Higgs and was fascinated by his career. It's a very distinguished one that includes starting a very important law firm, advising governors and other politicians on important nominations like judgeships, chairing an important redistricting committee. But the thing which struck me most strongly in looking at his biography was DeWitt Higgs's 16 years of service on the Board of Regents here in California. What struck me most was he served as chairman and vice chairman between 1968 and 1971, which are rather important years for this university. Among other things, he was prominently involved with a movement in this area and partly on this campus to start termination proceedings against Angela Davis and Herbert Marcuse. I don't know if there's anybody here who remembers those times. Perhaps there are one or two people. He stood very strongly for academic freedom at the time, and I had an interesting discussion with his son Craig about this just a few minutes ago in the reception. And it reminds me that our values, what we say we stand for, are tested in times of enormous stress. Now, that is a platitude, and that platitude is usually uttered not in times of enormous stress. We are at a similar period of our history now. The Dean Drake mentioned that I reported on Central America, on Salvador, on Haiti. Many of the conflicts I covered had to do in the most basic way with human rights. They had to do with torture. They had to do with massacres. They had to do with the use of power to terrorize populations. And they had to do with the failure of many societies to adhere to the rule of law except in name. I never thought my attention would be turned when it came to issues of torture, domestic spying, mass arrest, to this country. I'm still somewhat stunned by it, frankly. And what I hope to do tonight is try to put together a number of the disparate phenomena that people who are interested in human rights and the law have looked at over the last 4 years in particular, as questionable activities as violations of the law, as overreachings of presidential power. I hope to try to put those together into some kind of context. My title, Into the Light of Day, really suggests a particular argument. That argument is that what we have been looking at over the last 4 years, we can call a state of exception. Other terms for this are state of emergency, state of siege. There are martial law in the English tradition. And while we have been looking at these various phenomena I mentioned as disparate things, in fact, as we come into the light of day and we're starting to have political discussions about these issues, we've entered a different and more perilous stage. That is, when we didn't know about domestic eavesdropping, when we didn't know about in-depth interrogation, as it's called, extreme interrogation, otherwise known as torture, when we didn't know about the wholesale arrest of aliens, we essentially were not confronted with the moral question of whether or not this society approved it. More and more every day, these questions are staring us in the face as the National Security Agency eavesdropping is today. And the question for the society is, for all of us, and I take very much to heart what the Chancellor said about this, these questions involve all of us. What is now staring us in the face is, after we know about this, do we approve it? So all of these moral questions and legal questions are coming right now, in my view, into the light of day. The question is, what will be our decision regarding them? I'm going to begin tonight with a little story. It happened about 2 months after the attacks of 9/11 in December 2001, almost 3 months, at a small airport outside of Stockholm. I'm going to give you an account. There are a number of accounts of this, but the best one and the one I'm going to quote from is written by Craig Whitlock of the Washington Post. He begins, "The CIA Gulfstream 5 jet touched down at a small airport west of here just before 9 p.m. on a sub-freezing night in December 2001. A half dozen agents wearing hoods that covered their faces stepped down from the aircraft and hurried across the tarmac to take custody of two prisoners, suspected Islamic radicals from Egypt." Now, many of you will have recognized that this is a story, this little drama is a story in the history of a practice called extraordinary rendition, whereby allies of the United States and sometimes agents of the United States itself seize people off the streets of European, generally European countries, bundle them off, and send them to other countries to be interrogated, most often to Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Yemen, Jordan, other places, usually in the Middle East. The U.S. has claimed that the government is assured before these people are sent off to these places that they will not be abused in any way. What we know about this practice is that of the 200 or so who have been snatched, kidnapped in this way, many have been very severely abused. But let me go on with my little story. Inside an airport police station, Swedish officers watched as the CIA operatives pulled out scissors and rapidly sliced off the prisoners' clothes, including their underwear. They probed inside the men's mouths and ears and examined their hair before dressing the pair in sweatsuits and draping hoods over their heads. Suspects were then marched in chains to the plane, where they were strapped to mattresses on the floor in the back of the cabin. What we find out later is that these CIA agents, in cutting this clothing off, these are men, remember, wearing hoods, dressed in black, who have not identified themselves to the Swedes, while they're cutting the things off and stripping these prisoners who are in handcuffs, suppositories are put into the prisoners to tranquilize them, to knock them out. They're chained to mattresses, flown off to Egypt. Now, the reason this is a little scene that's happened a couple of hundred times since 9/11. We don't know for sure. We can only estimate. But the best estimates suggest it's somewhere between 150 and 200 times. What is fascinating to me is the little comedy that was played out when the Swedes saw these operatives all dressed in black, with black masks, couldn't see their faces, the Swedish security police were taken aback by the swiftness and precision of the CIA agents that night. Investigators concluded that the Swedes essentially stood aside and let the Americans take control of the operation, moving silently and communicating with hand signals. There's a quote here from an assistant director of the National Police of Sweden who says, who was at there at the airport, he says, "We were surprised when a crew stepped out of the plane that seemed to be very professional, that had obviously done this before. A Swedish officer had walked up the steps of the plane to greet the Americans and was shocked to find several men standing there completely covered in hoods who would essentially not reply to him. There were no people he could recognize. There were simply these men who were giving hand signals with semi-opaque fabric around the face, even though the Swede told him," or I should quote this, "I told them," says the assistant director of Sweden's police, "I told them that you don't need to wear hoods because there's no one here," the officer recalled. The foreign agents ignored him. The Swedish police said they were also perplexed by a demand from U.S. agents that they be allowed to strip search the prisoners, even though the two men had already been searched and were in handcuffs. The Swedes relented after the captain of the plane said he would refuse to depart unless the Americans were allowed to do things their way. So the clothing, even though these men had been arrested, searched, handcuffed, so on, their clothing was cut off, suppositories were forcibly inserted into them, they were put in jumpsuits, chained to the mattresses in the plane, and flown off after being forcibly drugged in this way. They had hoods put on their heads, which covered everything like a big cone. These black hoods were put over the prisoners' heads. Now, why have I gone on with this story? You can, after all, read about it in many, many accounts. The New Yorker had a very long one about rendition. This is only part of the state of exception, as I've called it, that has been imposed, I'm going to argue, since 9/11. Something strikes me about this, however, which is that in the customary way that we talk about human rights and human values, which is really at the heart of what this country is about, that is, it is there in the founding documents, in the Declaration of Independence about inalienable rights, in the Bill of Rights, obviously elaborated, and in various ways in the Constitution. When we look, if we want to look at a so-called balance between security and human rights, the balance in this scene is tipped completely in one way. That is, not only did these gentlemen who were being arrested not represent a threat, they had been searched, they were completely clean of weapons. Security was the only concern. Human rights had no value here. And I'd remind you all, since I'm on a university campus, I'm going to go ahead and quote Kant. I hope that's okay. I think we have a lot of dimensions of culture students here tonight. Is that right? Yes? Where are you? Okay. Well, I'm going to quote Kant for you. Kant said, "Act in such a way that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of another, always at the same time as an end, and never simply as a means." Now, this is stated in a bit of a perhaps complicated way, but it's a very simple idea. A human being can never be a means to an end. A human being has certain inherent rights as a human being. And the idea of human rights, implicit in many, as I say, of our founding documents, takes that as a starting point. And in that airport in Sweden, and I'll argue many other places around the globe in the last 4 years, we have seen the utter reversal of that idea. That is, security is all, the rights of the human being are nothing. They don't, in effect, exist. After 9/11, President Bush, by his own account, asked the various agencies of government to come to him with their proposals about how to stop an event like this from ever happening again. He and Vice President Cheney as well have told us at various times what they had in mind, what they asked for from the rest of the government. First of all, he said recently in a press conference, right after September the 11th, "I knew we were fighting a different kind of war. And so I asked people in my administration to analyze how best for me and our government to do the job people expect us to do, which is to detect and prevent a possible attack. That's what the American people want. What we quickly learned was that al-Qaeda was not a conventional enemy. Some lived in our cities and communities and communicated from here in America to plot and plan with bin Laden's lieutenants in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere. Then they boarded our airplanes and launched the worst attack on our country and our nation's history. This new threat, said the president, required us to act and think differently. To prevent this from happening again, we need to connect the dots before the enemy attacks, not after. As president and commander-in-chief, I have the constitutional responsibility and the authority to protect our country. Now, this is his account of what he was thinking after 9/11. As he said, after September the 11th, one question my administration had to answer was, using the authorities I have, how do we effectively detect enemies hiding in our midst and prevent them from striking us again? Now, there's another account of what President Bush said in the days after 9/11. It comes to us from Richard Clark, who was in charge of counterterrorism for many years within several administrations and was still working in a job related to that in the first days of the Bush administration. He records the president telling the National Security Staff that evening, "Any barriers in your way," he said, "they are gone. I don't care what the international lawyers say, we're going to kick some ass." That's Richard Clark's view. In the days after 9/11, a phrase became current within the administration. We've heard it again and again. I heard it in Iraq from American officials there on several occasions. It was, "From now on, or at this point, we're going to take the gloves off." I heard it from an interrogator at Abu Ghraib. I heard it from various other officials, and the American people heard it from the head of counterterrorism in the CIA, Kofor Black, who said, "All you need to know about very classified, highly operational activities after 9/11 is that there was a before 9/11 and there was an after 9/11. After 9/11, the gloves came off." Now, there's an interesting bit of rhetoric there that I think we should think about, which is to say the assumption that before 9/11, the gloves were on. There is a particular idea here about power, which is the assumption that the United States is unable to defend itself with the system it has, that those gloves in some way prevented the U.S. and its intelligence agencies from finding clues to the coming attack, from otherwise dismantling terrorist networks, from protecting the country. That is the assumption underlying that statement, and I would argue the assumption that the administration has essentially embraced is that the system in place, which involved laws against torture and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment of prisoners, which included laws against wiretapping of Americans without a warrant, which included prohibitions on the kinds of arrests the United States has made in the days after 9/11 of aliens, for example. About 5,500 were arrested. Somewhere below 6,000 were arrested. That system is unable to protect the United States in this new paradigm that we have entered. That is a rock-bottom assumption. There are a couple of other parts of that assumption that I think are important to point to. First is that the people who took power in 2001, the Bush administration, have a particular idea of executive power. A couple of points about this. The first idea is that presidential power was unjustly, illegitimately limited during the early 70s. At the top of the Bush administration, obviously, the two most powerful officials are Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, and Vice President Richard B. Cheney, both of whom were high executive officials during the Nixon and Ford administrations, and saw many of these provisions enacted during the last days of the Vietnam War and in the wake of Watergate. I'm talking about the War Powers Resolution, for example. FISA, which had its birth in the mid-70s, although it was not enacted until 1978, And these officials have felt in the time since that these restrictions on presidential power were illegitimate. Vice President Cheney has actually stated this explicitly, as he did in the days after the first unveiling of the National Security Agency wiretapping program. He told reporters on his plane, they were flying over Oman in the Persian Gulf. Over the years, he says, there has been an erosion of presidential power and authority, and it's reflected in a number of developments, the War Powers Act, which many people believe is unconstitutional. I'm one of those who believe that was an infringement upon the authority of the president. Watergate, a lot of the things around Watergate and Vietnam, both served to erode the authority the president needs to be effective, especially in the national security area. And he goes on to talk about Iran-Contra, essentially arguing that the president had the power to do what was done in Iran-Contra, which was essentially circumventing the Congress to fund the Contras through illegal arms sales. So he is a man who believes very strongly that the Congress had gotten too much power. He said the proper balance has now been, is beginning to be restored. I do think it's swung back, he said. So at the very beginning, you had an administration that had been attacked, that felt they could do, must do anything to protect the country. I would argue there's a psychopolitical current here in which the knowledge, I don't want to sound like Marcuse here, but the inherent knowledge that they had, which is that they had been warned about al-Qaeda wanting to attack the United States, caused a particularly strong reaction. That is, they knew that documents that would come out showed that they had been explicitly warned of at least an attack coming the following fall. You had an administration that had been attacked that was absolutely determined to increase presidential power to prevent a second attack. You had a number of high officials who were absolutely determined to increase presidential power at all costs. You had also in the Department of Justice a number of officials who believed very strongly in something they call the unitary executive, which many of the law professors in the audience, I'm sure, know a lot about. They essentially believe that the president's power as commander-in-chief allows him to do anything during wartime. That is, that there are very broad areas of presidential responsibility that during wartime cannot be restricted by an act of Congress, including previously existing acts like the Convention Against Torture, which is a treaty on the books, acts like FISA, which restricts domestic surveillance. Finally, you had within the U.S. government, and this goes beyond the Bush administration, a defense culture, particularly in the national security bureaucracies, the Department of Defense, the intelligence bureaucracies, that essentially had been shaped to meet the Cold War and that had been partially defunded during the 90s, after the end of the Cold War, but that had been built bureaucratically to respond to a threat from an opposite state, an ideological rival. And this very much influenced how this administration responded to the attacks of 9/11. And I would argue led partly to the attack on Iraq. That is the necessity for this government to respond, put it this way, states like to fight states. They don't like to fight small terrorist groups. And when you look, I'm going to read you a short quote from the Defense Science Board, which is a body within the Department of Defense that has studied, in a very interesting way, the United States' reaction to 9/11. This is very briefly. Washington policy and defense cultures still seek out Cold War models, wrote these authors within the Defense Department. With the surprise announcement of a new struggle, the U.S. government reflexively inclined toward Cold War-style responses to the new threat, without a thought or a care as to whether these were the best responses to a very different strategic situation. So this is the Defense Department essentially criticizing itself. Finally, when we try to understand why this administration responded in the way it did, I would list as the last factor the attitude of the leading officials in the administration, toward power. That is, the United States now has, in their view, a preponderance of power. Now, this is not unprecedented. It was certainly the case after World War II that there was no rival state that could come close to the United States militarily, politically, or economically. At that time, as many of you know, in the late 40s, early 50s, the United States responded to this situation, the Truman administration and then the Eisenhower administration, by seeking to increase that power, to leverage it, as it were, by setting up multilateral institutions. That is, the U.S., as the leading state, decided to become a leader and to institutionalize its leadership role through the United Nations, through NATO, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Marshall Plan, among other things. Now, we have, in after 9/11, similar situation. The United States, preponderant of power, no rivals to it, and it reacts in a very different way, which is to say unilaterally. And I would argue the reason for this is because the officials in charge have a very different attitude than Harry Truman, Dean Acheson, Robert Lovett, the other so-called wise men of the late 40s and early 50s. They believe, and I will quote one line from a remarkable document, the National Defense Strategy, "Our strength as a nation state will continue to be challenged by those who employ a strategy of the weak using international fora, judicial processes, and terrorism." I want to read that again because it's an amazing sentence. "Our strength as a nation state will continue to be challenged by those who employ a strategy of the weak using international fora, judicial processes, and terrorism." In other words, international institutions, international law, so the United Nations, the court systems, are grouped along with terrorism as weapons of the weak. This is a way other lesser states and other lesser rivals of the U.S. can tie the United States down, can limit its power. And it bespeaks a certain attitude toward law, toward the rule of law, that I think is unique, at least in my experience in writing about the American government. That is, the law is an instrument of power. And for the most powerful state, the law is a threat. The law is, like international institutions, like the United Nations, and like terrorism, the law is a way for the weak to tie down, limit, and paralyze the most powerful. The law is like the strings holding down Gulliver. The Lilliputians use this as they use terrorism. It's an attitude, I think, that is absolutely critical. So, what was the consequence of this? What is the heart of the Bush administration's state of exception? Well, several things we know about, but I'm going to list them. One is the military order of November 13th, 2001, in which the Geneva Convention, the military order of November 13th, 2001, in which prisoners were declared essentially unlawful combatants. That is, they were put outside of the rule of law, which together with a decision by President Bush essentially withheld the protection of the Geneva Convention from prisoners taken in Afghanistan, which allowed the shipment of those prisoners to Guantanamo, to a place that, as a British, distinguished British juror called it, is in effect a legal black hole. At one time, there were 700, probably more than 700 prisoners there. We don't know their names. Some of them we now do. But they were shipped there with no rights of any kind, no rights of legal review, no right to attorneys, obviously. And in this sense, the administration, in effect, declared the end of, in effect, I say, knowing there are lawyers in this crowd, the end of habeas corpus. Habeas corpus is one of the fundamental building blocks that this legal regime, our society, is built on. It means that a sovereign cannot come to your house, take you, arrest you, take you away, do whatever it wants with you without some degree of explanation. Habeas corpus means produce the body. tell us where this person is, what they've done. We need some sort of rationale and due process here. And Guantanamo, among other things, was in effect the end of habeas corpus for a particular class of persons. The Bush administration at the same time was contemplating, as we now know, suspending habeas corpus within the United States. It was a proposal of then-Attorney General Ashcroft, which officials in the Justice Department decided went a little too far. What else did they do? Well, let me, because time is growing late, let me try to summarize a couple of things here. The Geneva Convention suspended for, in essence, the first time. A very large series of arrests within the United States of aliens, of non-Americans, who were arrested on basically a lot of a great number of pretexts. The phrase that Attorney General Ashcroft used was the paradigm of prevention, a paradigm we see a lot in the rhetoric of interior Bush administration discussions. Alberto Gonzalez, then the White House counsel, now the Attorney General, talked about the war on terror being a new paradigm that rendered obsolete and even quaint provisions of the Geneva Convention. David Cole, who is one of my predecessors at this podium in this lecture series, summarized what was done domestically in the following way. On this theory, that is the paradigm of prevention, the administration subjected 80,000 Arab and Muslim immigrants to fingerprinting and registration, sought out 8,000 Arab and Muslim men for FBI interviews, and imprisoned over 5,000 foreign nationals in anti-terrorism preventive detention initiatives. This was essentially simply a roundup. We have to get these people off the street. And they were indeed rounded up by the thousands. As part of this program, the government adopted an aggressive strategy of arrest and prosecution, holding people on minor charges, in fact pretexts, such as immigration violations, credit card fraud, or false statements, or when it had no charges at all, as material witnesses. He puts that in quotes. And he has a quite extensive list of other domestic programs undertaken at that time. The AP has done an estimate, very interesting piece, in which they have estimated that the United States detained so far in the war on terror, this was several months ago, 83,000 people. 83,000. And the image they used in the Associated Press, they said that FedEx Field in Washington, D.C., the largest NFL field, largest National Football League field, holds 90,000. So essentially, the number of detainees since the war on terror began could fill the largest stadium in the United States. We still are holding about 15,000 in Iraq. Okay. I want to talk about what I would call the limiting, the extreme case in the state of exception, which is torture, and which I have spent a lot of time over the past couple of years writing about. Torture is a very complicated story, extreme interrogation. We have known that it was going on since the middle of 2002. The Washington Post published a piece called U.S. Decries Abuse But Defends Interrogation, Stress and Duress Tactics Used on Terrorism Suspects Held in Secret Overseas Facilities. This was 4 years ago. And has much of what we know now about techniques that were being used on prisoners, including waterboarding, beatings, 24-hour bombardment with very loud noise, very loud music, and sleep deprivation over many days. Also the use of hot and cold, of adjustment of temperature, as that's called, this is called. Because we're in very much the realm here when we talk about torture, the realm of euphemism. Now, what is interesting to me, and I'm going to read just a bit about what this actually involves, what's interesting to me is that we know about it. I've written about it. We have detailed accounts of it. And in fact, we have learned to live with it. The message that's most important, I think, when it comes to talking about torture, is that torture has survived its exposure. And again, my title tonight is Into the Light of Day. That is, will it continue to survive its exposure? All right, when we talk about torture, what exactly are we talking about? As I say, we enter the realm of euphemism here very quickly. We talk about adjustment of environment. We talk about sensory deprivation. We talk about sleep deprivation. What exactly do these things mean? I want to read you the account of a detainee at Abu Ghraib. His name, well, we don't know his name. He's detainee 7. It's a very difficult thing to hear, but I think it's important because it's one of the most explicit, detailed accounts we have of what actually was going on in that prison and what is going on still in various parts of the U.S. Prison system, secret prison system. Detainee 7 was arrested at a roadblock in Iraq. He had been a Republican guard. Therefore, he was taken prisoner. The thought was, this was fall of 2003 when the insurgency was heating up and the American forces in Iraq had no idea where it came from, had no idea who was staging these bombings, had no idea how to find them. As Vice President Cheney and others have underlined, to fight an insurgency, the critical thing is not tanks, it's not missiles, it's not nuclear weapons, it's intelligence. You have to be able to distinguish who the insurgents are from the broader population. So the United States began a series of operations called cordon and captures, in which a block, a house, a block, a neighborhood was cordoned off, houses were systematically searched, and young men generally were arrested, brought to Abu Ghraib, and then interrogated. And the idea was, we're desperate, we need intelligence, we have to find it somewhere. Do what you need to do. The gloves have come off. Detainee 7 gives this account of what happened to him. The first day, they put me in a dark room and started hitting me in the head and stomach and legs. They made me raise my hands and sit on my knees. This is called a stress position. I was like that for 4 hours. So he's kneeling down with his hands up in the air for 4 hours. Then the interrogator came, and he was looking at me while they were beating me. Then I stayed in this room for 5 days, naked with no clothes. They put handcuffs on my hand, and they cuffed me high for 7 or 8 hours. And that, so this is handcuffing the prisoner either behind his back, or he's talking now about being cuffed like this. The idea is to make the prisoner stand on his toes. You put pressure on the shoulder, on the side of the body. You try to pop the shoulder, essentially. They cuffed me high for 7 or 8 hours. That caused a rupture to my right hand. I had a cut that was bleeding and had pus coming from it. They kept me this way on 24, 25, 26 October. So he's cuffed like this, naked, in his cell. On the following days, they also put a bag over my head, and of course, this whole time I was without clothes and without anything to sleep on. And one day in November, they started a different type of punishment, where an American police, he means MPs, military police, came in my room, put the bag over my head and cuffed my hands, took me out of the room into the hallway. He started beating me, him and 5 other American police. I could see their feet only from under the bag. A couple of those police, they were female, because I heard their voices, and I saw 2 of the police that were hitting me before they put the bag over my head, the hood. One of them was wearing glasses. I couldn't read his name because he put tape over his name. Some of the things they did was to make me sit down like a dog. They would hold the string from the bag, and they made me bark like a dog. They were laughing at me. One of the police was telling me to crawl in Arabic, so I crawled on my stomach, and the police were spitting on me when I was crawling and hitting me. Then the police started beating me on my kidneys, and then they hit me on my right ear, and it started bleeding, and I lost consciousness. Now, I'm going to skip a few passages here, but essentially his ear is mostly torn off. He loses consciousness. There's a lot of blood, and one of the MPs comes in and sews it back on in the cell. A few days before they hit me on my ear, the American police put red women's underwear over my head. Then he tied me to the window that is in the cell with my hands behind my back until I lost consciousness. Again, this is a stress position. The idea is to push the person forward, push his shoulders out of their sockets, essentially. After the guy with the glasses got tired, 2 of the American soldiers brought me to the ground, tied my hands to the door while laying down on my stomach. One of the police was pissing on me and laughing at me. The soldier and his friend told me in a loud voice to lie down, so I did that. And then, remember, he's naked, he has a hood over his head. Then the policeman was opening my legs with a bag over my head, and he sat down between my legs on his knees, and I was looking at him from under the bag, and they wanted to do me because I saw him and he was opening his pants. So I started screaming loudly, and the other police started hitting me with his feet on my neck, and he put his feet on my head so I couldn't scream. Then they put the loudspeaker inside the room, and they closed the door, and he was yelling into the microphone. That is called, in the euphemism, the use of noise to induce stress. They took me to the room, and they signaled me to get onto the floor. One of the police, he put a part of his stick that he always carries inside my ass. I felt it going inside me about 2 centimeters approximately. I started screaming. He pulled it out, washed it with water inside the room. And then 2 American girls that were, he means MPs, female MPs, that were there when they were beating me, they were hitting me with a ball made of sponge on my dick. When I was tied up in my room, one of the girls with blonde hair, she's white, she was playing with my dick. Again, he has his hands handcuffed behind him. They were taking pictures of me during all these instances. Now, this was a couple of years ago. You've seen pictures from this time. Everybody here has. Today, more of those pictures came out. I don't know what sort of coverage they will get. But I want to make a couple points about this. And I'm sorry to read something that's very unpleasant to hear, but I think it's important to hear what exactly we're talking about. The first thing is it was systematic over a great number of days. It continued for hours. The second is that the activity sounds grotesque and outlandish, you know, sadistic on a very basic level. I mean, it's essentially the narrative of the pictures that you're familiar with, which you look at these and say, ugh, you know, look at this. This couldn't have been ordered by anybody. This is sort of outlandish, awful, sadistic behavior. And that assumption on the part of most normal people, I use that word advisedly, you know, that's a natural assumption. You're thinking, well, no commander could order this kind of thing. Now, we have heard since the spring of 2004 that this stuff was carried on by, quote, a few bad apples. Now, that phrase, interestingly enough, as probably some of the lawyers in the audience know, is a term of art. That is, governments tend to use this defense when they are accused of torture. The government of the United Kingdom did so in the early 70s, in a very famous torture case there called the Five Techniques. So you say it's a few bad apples, you prosecute a few people lower down, and that is a story that you tell to the public. But if you study this issue at all, if you take any time on it, if you read the various reports that have been written about torture, about the events that I've sketched for you, it's very clear that it was systematic activity. There was sadism involved at Abu Ghraib, certainly. But it's very clear that the lowering of standards for what you could do in interrogation, standards that previously in the American military since George Washington had been quite high, that the lowering of standards, the strong push for information, and the permitting of the CIA to use techniques, which unfortunately I don't have much time to talk about, which are much more extensive and systematic, all of these things contributed to an active use of what I would consider torture in American interrogation. And that those techniques, from what we know, were probably not very successful in gaining information. This is something that's debated quite a bit. But they led to a catastrophic political failure when they were broadcast and published. And that failure, as we sit here tonight, with the United States focused on how many pellets our vice president put into the body of his hunting companion, in the Middle East, are actually becoming a matter of great controversy once again, with the new pictures being broadcast. The pictures, by the way, are broadcast. The ACLU has brought a lawsuit saying all of these pictures should come out. There are about 2,000 of them, and a good deal of videotape as well. The American government has taken the position, first it refused to publish them or to release them, then it took the position that We cannot release them because it will hurt the war effort. Now, of course, that predicate is quite correct. It will hurt the war effort. But the consequence one should, or the conclusion one should draw from that is the activity shouldn't take place, not that it's wrong to expose it. I want to try to finish, though, by quoting an interrogator, a military interrogator. He wrote a book called The Interrogators. He wrote it under a pseudonym. For those of you who are interested in these issues, interrogation, human rights, I urge you very strongly to get this book. It's an account of what happens during interrogation, and it's an account from someone who worked in Afghanistan and is horrified by what developed thereafter. One of the things that's most interesting about him is that he is very forthright. He does not say, as many liberal opponents of torture do, it doesn't work anyway. He concedes that sometimes it might work. I find this argument, by the way, it makes me cringe. It doesn't work anyway. Because I think, well, what if you can prove it does? Is that the reason we're not using it, that it doesn't work? He says, his pseudonym is Chris Mackey, if a prisoner will say anything to stop the pain, my guess is he will start with the truth. Our experience, though they never contravened the conventions, the Geneva Conventions, let alone crossed over into torture, the harsher the methods we used, the better the information we got, and the sooner we got it. Other agencies of the government, he means the CIA, seem to have learned the same lesson. He concludes, the reason the United States should not torture prisoners is not because it doesn't work. It is simply because it is wrong. It dehumanizes us, undermines our cause, and over the long term breeds more enemies of the United States than coercive interrogation methods will ever allow us to capture. There's another argument, and it goes back to where I started. It has to do with the Enlightenment. It has to do with Kant. It has to do with many of the issues involving human rights and where our society came from, what makes our society distinctive. And it has to do basically with the autonomy of the individual. That is, when you violate somebody's physical space, when you beat him, torture him, violate him in the way we saw just now in those accounts, and I could have read you 100 of them. There are many of them. We're doing something that's the polar opposite of freedom. We're banishing freedom from the human body, from the human soul. We all have minds, bodies, souls. When we use pain to violate the individual, we're coming close to our notion of our evil twin during the Cold War, which is to say totalitarianism. Liberalism, in its broadest sense, not human rights, not the Democratic Party, liberal government, in the sense of the government the United States formed 200-odd years ago, has at its very heart the autonomy of the individual and the limitation, the consequent limitation of government power. Torture is the most obvious and most dramatic case of unlimited government power. And the final thing I'd say about the state of exception, and I've done no more than trace it for you tonight, is that it is unlimited in space and in time. We don't know when the war on terror will end. We have no idea how we will know it has ended. We know that as far as space goes, the war on terror, as defined by the Bush administration, is being fought all over the world, in secret prisons, in countries in Asia, Africa, Europe, elsewhere, and within the borders of the United States. There's a wonderful book called State of Exception, about 90 pages, by a philosopher named Giorgio Agamben. He has this summary. a state which has security as its sole task and source of legitimacy is a fragile organism. It can always be provoked by terrorism to become itself terroristic. When politics, he writes, reduces itself to police, the difference between state and terrorism threatens to disappear. In the end, security and terrorism may form a single deadly system in which they justify and legitimate each other's actions. Nothing is more important than a revision of the concept of security as a basic principle of state politics. I have one last comment, and then I'll give way, and you've been a very patient audience, to what I hope will be a vivid discussion. And that is, my title in the end comes from Fidelio, Beethoven's single opera. Are there those in the audience who know Fidelio? Well, the opera sketches out a dichotomy of figurative language between the light and the dark. The dark, the cold, is the dungeon, the darkness of the dungeon, the cold of the lack of human contact, the darkness and cold of autocracy. The light is the light of day, the light of freedom. And I urge you all to see this opera. I saw it shortly after the Abu Ghraib photographs were first broadcast and was particularly struck by two things. One was an exchange by the heroine, in which the heroine of the opera, who is disguised as a man in the way of operas, her name is Leonora, she's disguised as Fidelio, she's searching for her husband, who she knows is a prisoner in this fortress. She knows he's down in the dungeon of the fortress. Sleep deprivation, sensory deprivation, it's all there. We're talking about 1804. And she asks the jailer in her disguise, she asks about the prisoner, how long has he been a prisoner, she asks. The jailer says, 2 years. 2 years, says Leonora, he must be a great criminal. The jailer says, or he must have great enemies. You have two different views there of how we rule ourselves and how we use power. On the one hand, the rule of force, he must have great enemies. Those enemies can do with him what they will. And on the other hand, the rule of law, he must be a great criminal. He must have done something to have caused this imprisonment according to the lawful state. The climactic scene of this opera is the prisoner's chorus, in which they come out of the dungeon into the light. And you can feel in your bones a vision that Beethoven had in the early 19th century, the first years of the 19th century, that the time of autocracy was past, that torture, arbitrary power, despotism were all connected. They were all connected to darkness. And that the era that he was seeing ushered in was going to be the era of the light. And it seems to me that the final reason to think seriously about the state of exception in which we live now and the practices to which we have reverted, including torture and interrogation, is that, to me, nothing is clearer. They represent a move backward into the darkness. Thank you very much for your attention tonight.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.